So the Treasurer was very big picture. I am going right into the entrails of the financial system. It's quite a contrast, I have to say. So I said he was very big picture. I am going down into the plumbing of the financial system. Now, why should you care about this? If you participate in financial markets, you should care about some of these issues. And part of the problem over the last decade or so is that not enough people have. So with that by way of background, so what I'm going to talk about today, as I said, is complete contrast to what you just heard. It's actually about benchmark rates. And as I said, why should you care about them? It's because you all use them, even if you don't realize them. So as I said, this issue might seem arcane to some, but like Jonathan Richman, I keep my place in the arcane. So that we're going to stay in the arcane for the next 15, 20 minutes or so. So benchmarks are right at the heart of the plumbing of the financial system. So if you're an investor with any exposure to a global or fixed income product, you're using a benchmark, even if you don't know it. And so they've been taken for granted for most of the past couple of decades, but over the last 5 years or so, they've come right into the public domain. They're a multi-billion dollar source of revenue for the US government and also for the UK government. That's because they've been fining a lot of people. They've also been generating a lot of legal cases. They've attracted considerable regulatory scrutiny and reform to address some of these deficiencies, which have rendered them vulnerable to abuse, which they have been. So participating in this global reform project for benchmark rates has been my night job, still is my night job for the past 5 years, 3 years or so. And that's what I want to talk to you about today. As I said, you might not think you need to know about them, but you probably should. And in fact, the general neglect of them by financial market participants is, as I said, you never got to be always careful you don't blame the buy side for the sell side's sins. But anyway, a little more scrutiny from the buy side probably wouldn't have gone astray over the last few years or so. So what I want to talk about first is benchmark reform in the foreign exchange market, and also briefly about the work we're doing on developing a single code of conduct for the FX market, and then talk about interest rate benchmarks, and in particularly about the main domestic interest rate benchmark and some of the considerations around that. So I'll start with FX benchmarks. I said, so why should you care? So for starters, you might have a contract which explicitly references a particular FX benchmark, but probably more likely you invest in some sort of global portfolio, be it fixed income or equity. And it's highly likely that that portfolio uses an FX benchmark to weight the components across different markets. More than likely, it's probably the London 4pm fix, which is calculated by WM, not this organisation, but the competitor. Moreover, as the portfolio is rebalanced periodically, often at month end, to reflect movements in prices over the period, it is very likely that FX transactions to rebalance the FX component of your portfolio occur during the London 4pm fixing window to minimise the tracking error against the calculated benchmark. So the size of those flows are multi-billion dollars in the space of a couple of minutes. So reasonably large. So while you might think, as I said, you're investing in an equities or fixed income portfolio, you're actually passively investing in foreign exchange. So from early 2013, concerns were increasingly raised about the integrity of foreign exchange benchmarks, particularly around the potential for market misconduct in trading around the time of the benchmark fixings. So accordingly, the Financial Stability Board formed a group chaired by Paul Fisher at the Bank of England and me to firstly analyse the structure of the FX market and then come and the incentives that might be generating this inappropriate trading activity, and then come up with some potential remedies. So after talking to participants from all sides of the FX market around the world, in September 2014, we put out 15 recommendations to reform the FX benchmark process, which were endorsed by the FSB. They're in four main areas. They're around the benchmark methodology itself, the way transactions are actually executed around the benchmark, market conduct, and then some guidance on reference rates produced by central banks like ourselves. So earlier this year, at the request of Mark Carney, I chaired a group that summarised the progress that's occurred since we put out the report in September 2014. And we put that out last month, drawing on information gathered by the FX committees and central banks in the major foreign exchange centres. So what I want to do quickly is provide a summary of what's happened in this space over the past year and highlight some areas where there's still more to occur. So in terms of the benchmark methodology, we made a number of recommendations concerning how WM calculate the London 4pm fix. In particular, we recommended widening the fixing window. So it used to be 1 minute. We recommended it be widened. And so from February 15th this year, WM widened it from 1 minute to 5 minutes. Might sound like a lot, but in this space, in FX, 1 minute is a long time, 5 minutes is an eternity. So this widening of the window appears to be helping to achieve the outcomes we are looking to achieve. And we, in the progress report, we contain some data analysis to support this. So it's fairly early days yet. We've had only a few month ends. So month ends, the flows are 5 or 6 times larger than they are in any other day of the month as these monthly rebalancings occur. But so far, it would appear so good. And if you're interested in the details, so if you're really interested in the entrails, I'd recommend reading section 3 of our report. We have a lot of information about how the dynamics of the market have changed around this time, including for the Aussie. So the wider window has also helped to highlight the risk transfer involved between the buy side firm initiating the transaction and the sell side firm executing it for them. This in turn was very helpful in the communication of another of our recommendations, which got a reasonable amount of attention, naming that fixing transactions should actually be charged for. So previously, transactions were often executed for free, at least notionally. As it turns out, they probably weren't quite so free, as you didn't actually pay for them in terms of the price, but you paid for them in other ways. The free cost of the transaction probably increased the incentive for manipulation as trading desks sought to generate greater profitability to compensate for the fact that they weren't being paid for what they were doing. The widening of the window in February served as a focal point for sell-side firms to start charging for these services. So most sell-side respondents to our survey said that they're now charging for fixing transactions, particularly around the London 4pm and especially the most liquid currency pairs. That said, some respondents who tended to be smaller banks less active in the fix said they were still reviewing their procedures for benchmark orders. Meanwhile, moreover, while there'd been good progress in terms of the London fix, there are a whole lot of other fixes all around the world and there's been much less progress around them. And the scope for benchmark manipulation is there for all fixes, not just the London 4pm. And so it's important to reiterate that the recommendations of our report are intended for all FX benchmarks, not just London 4pm. So how are people actually paying for these fixes now? So a mix of pricing strategies are being used. Some just go a straight bid offer. Some a fixed fee, where the fee is actually based on calculating the risk transfer between the sell side firm and the buy side firm. Others are pursuing a strategy which is roughly called Rent My Algo, where a firm provides access for a fee to an algorithmic trading tool to directly execute the fixing transaction in the fixing window. So another one of the recommendations we made was that banks should have separate processes for handling their fixing orders from other orders. So what was happening, and you can see this in some of the prosecutions which have been done, was that banks were using the information they had in their fixing orders to execute some of their other orders. So what we recommended is that those two processes be separated. The way a lot of banks have gone about doing that is they now they've shifted their execution of fixing orders from the spot voice trading FX desk to an electronic trading desk that executes them with algorithms. And so in our report, we show that the share of algorithmic trading in the FX market has gone up considerably, particularly in the fixing window. So there's also obviously considerably enhanced internal scrutiny from senior management around fixing transactions. The odd $1 billion fine tends to focus the mind of senior management, presuming they retain their jobs. Some firms have physically separated their fixing desks from other desks. And in fact, one thing you'll notice if you go on to the standard FX trading floor now, there are just a hell of a lot less people there than there used to be. But the people that are there tend to be much more compliance people and a lot less trading. So there's roughly two compliance people for every trader now, and there's just a lot less traders and a lot more machines. So this obviously, the segregation has involved some costs, and so some participants in the market have decided that they just can't afford these costs and they've exited the market. And what they'll do is they'll offer their service. They'll still be in the FX business, but in terms of fixing, they'll just provide a portal straight through to one of the larger participants' services. But some have decided that they will stay in there and try and ignore our recommendation, which I'm not sure is a sustainable strategy. As I said, our recommendations were to apply to all participants, but with appropriate consideration to the size and structure of the market. In terms of market conduct, we made a number of recommendations around appropriate sharing of information, including around trading positions beyond that necessary for a transaction, and particularly customer information. Again, that may not be so good for new services such as this in terms of getting colour on some of the transactions, but some of the colour that was being provided between market participants was probably above and beyond what was necessary to actually execute the transaction. So those principles around information sharing were picked up in a statement which was put out by the Global Foreign Exchange Committees in Tokyo earlier this year. Many market participants have reflected these principles in their internal policies. There's a lot less information being shared between market participants now than was the case a few years ago. More broadly, in terms of improving market conduct, in May this year, the BIS governors commissioned a working group of the Markets Committee of the BIS that I chair to facilitate the establishment of a single global code of conduct for the foreign exchange market. It's always nice to come up with a code of conduct. It's even better if you can actually get people to follow the code of conduct. And so one of the other things we've been tasked with is coming up with ways to get people to actually follow the code. So I'm chairing this work along with Simon Potter of the New York Fed, who's leading the work on developing the code itself, and Chris Salmon of the Bank of England, who's leading the adherence work. It's a very much a global effort. It's the 15 largest foreign exchange centres in the world involved. And we're also being supported in this work by a group of market participants chaired by David Poof of CLS. It contains people from all around the world on both the buy side, including corporates, and the sell side, along with trading platforms and non-bank participants. So the idea is to come up with a single code to replace the various regional industry codes by May 2017, a bit over 18 months away, but we're not going to disappear and appear like Moses coming down from the mountain with a bunch of commandments. In between times, by May 2016, we're going to put out some parts of the code, particularly around order handling and execution, where a lot of the more controversial activities have taken place. Anyway, I'll talk more about this next week at another talk. So why have I taken the time to run you through all of this? As I said, as market participants, regardless of which side of the market you're on, it's important you're aware of the changes that have occurred and are still underway in the FX market. If you're on the sell side, I would trust that you are more than well aware of these, possibly painfully aware of these changes. And hopefully I provided you with some of the background and motivation for them. But as I said, if you're in the asset management business, you may not have paid much attention to the FX aspect of your business. But it's important that you also understand the context for the changes that are occurring. Some practices that you were accustomed to in the past, or maybe were unaware of, but that they're actually going on, may no longer be available or occurring, and you cannot expect your counterparty to provide them. So the motivation of these changes is to reduce the incentive and opportunity for improper trading by market participants. The implementation of the recommendations in our report, together with the enhanced scrutiny that's obviously occurring internally, appears to have moved the market in a favourable direction. And as we develop this single code of conduct, hopefully the market will move even further in that direction and allow market participants to have much greater confidence that the market is functioning appropriately. Confidence underpins all aspects of financial markets. At the moment, the FX market is not overly endowed with confidence in its operation. It's important we get it back to that state of affairs in the near future. Let me now turn briefly to interest rate benchmarks. And obviously, there's been a decent amount of scrutiny around this and a few people going to jail and paying the odd billion-dollar fine as well around LIBOR and other interest rate benchmarks. And so the FSB has also undertaken a reform effort around that to improve the functioning of those benchmarks. Interest rate benchmarks are also integral to the plumbing of the financial system. Many financial contracts reference interest rate benchmarks, but a lot of corporate lending contracts reference interest rate benchmarks. Derivative contracts generally are based on them, as are pretty much all asset-backed securities. So I'll focus on what we're doing in the local market, where the primary interest rate benchmark is the bank bill swap rate, or BBSW. As hopefully some of you are aware, a few weeks ago, the Council of Financial Regulators, which is us, ASIC, APRA and Treasury, issued a paper on possible reforms to BBSW. So I'll just quickly run through the motivation of why we're doing that, as well as some of the options. So BBSW is probably the most systemic important benchmark in our financial markets here in Australia. And so it's important there is ongoing confidence in it. As you may know, BBSW is calculated for a number of years by each day asking a panel of banks to submit their assessment of where the market was trading in bank paper at a particular time of the day. So it was a submissions-based process. It was different from LIBOR in that it was an assessment of the borrowing cost of a notional bank rather than your own funding costs. So, but given that a few years back, it looked like a whole bunch of people on that submission panel were about to stop being on that submission panel, there was a need to change the way that BBSW was calculated. And so since 2013, AFMA has calculated BBSW benchmark rates as the midpoint of a traded on traded platforms around in prime bank paper, which is the four major Australian banks, using live executable bid and offer prices sourced from the interbank trading venues at 10 a.m. every day. So while the stock of bills on issue has gone up and stands at around $140 billion today, trading during this rate set period has declined considerably to the point where on most days this year, there has been a number of days this year, there has been no trading. So we're taking this price off a trading platform on which there is no trading. So it's okay, the MUT system is actually working currently, but we're concerned that we want to make sure that at some point we don't get to the point where participants are less willing to use BBSW. And that's the motivation for this paper, is to ensure that BBSW remains a trusted, reliable and robust financial benchmark. What we do know is that the banks do actually issue paper every day, and a reasonable amount of it, a solid 100 million in bank bills are bought or sold on almost all business days. So it's not that there is no activity in the market, there's just no activity in the rate set itself. And so what, but the way that most of the transactions occur, and this has some quite a lot of similarities to the way the FX market was occurred, was that someone buying bank paper from a bank will agree to buy the paper ahead of the rate set at the yet-to-be-determined rate set, at no spread to the rate set. So this is agreeing to transact at a price, which you don't know what that price is, and then the price is determined after the fact. So if instead, rather than agreeing to be agreeing to transact at the rate set, people actually agreed to transact at an actual interest rate, you know, actual numbers, then these transactions may have the potential to underpin the BBSW benchmark. And so one of the options we put out there is that if we can encourage people to actually transact at a rate ahead of the rate set, and then that be the basis for the rate set itself. For that to be feasible, it'd be necessary for people to actually directly negotiate the interest rate rather than linking the rate to the rate set. Another option would be, which is similar to what's happened for LIBOR, would be for the banks to submit to the benchmark administrator their own assessment of their aggregate costs of wholesale funding based on their transactions that day. So that's the banks would do the aggregation, and then the administrator just needs to add up four numbers, one from each of the four major banks, or average four numbers. An alternative option would be for the banks to submit all their transactions data to the benchmark administrator, who would then itself do the aggregation, which is roughly what they're doing with Euribor in Europe. But both of these options have problems if there's no actual transactions on any particular day. The final option, which is still very much an option, is that we actually continue the system as it currently is, notwithstanding the very low turnover of the rate set. So this consultation, we asked the people's opinions between now and 3rd of December. And if you care about interest rate benchmarks, and as I said, if you're a participant in the financial markets, you probably should, I would ask that you consider making a submission. Finally, just before I get to finally, just also another thing that we are interested in pursuing along with AFMA is that a lot of people use BBSW without actually thinking about it. So that's the reference rate. So I just stick it in my financial market contract, regardless whether it's actually the most appropriate reference rate. Whereas in a number of cases, so BBSW is a credit-based reference rate. It's based on bank funding costs. For a lot of transactions, a risk-free benchmark is probably more appropriate. So for instance, in terms of swaps, people have moved from using BBSW to OIS over the last 5 years or so because it's actually much more appropriate. That's not the only product for which that's probably the case. So one example which where a change could be contemplated is for mortgage-backed securities. Mortgage-backed securities are all priced off 1 month BBSW. So when I said there was no turnover and no issue, but there was issuance still in bank paper, where there was almost no turnover and almost no issuance is in 1 month bank paper. And the reason for that is because since the introduction of the liquidity coverage ratio, banks don't have any incentive to issue 1 month paper, since they basically need to turn around and buy a government security on the other side of it. So not much point. And so the way that 30-day BBSW is priced these days is not the way it was in the past, and also there's just very little transactions underpinning it. It's probably not the right reference rate to be using to underpin the multi-billion dollar mortgage-backed security market. What exactly it could be is either something like OIS rates or potentially something like 90-day BBSW, but problem with that is that mortgage contracts generally, as we all know from personal experience, get reset monthly. As I said, there's consideration, you know, people should just ask the question, am I using the right reference rate? They should also understand the reference rate they're actually using, but they should ask the question, am I actually using the right reference rate, rather than this is the way it's always been done, so I'll keep doing that for the next decade or so. Finally, there's one other systemic benchmark that we care about in the interest rate space, which is the cash rate. As I said, it's also a systemic benchmark, underpins a lot of contracts. So what we're doing at the moment ourselves is also making sure that the way that's calculated is robust. I'm not saying it isn't robust currently, we're just making sure it's more robust. And so we're in the process of ensuring that our data collection is getting all the cash market trades appropriately and that we can actually match data from both sides of the transaction. So some market participants are aware of these changes. We don't expect them to actually affect the outcome. I'm pretty sure the cash rate will still look like the cash rate today. We're just making sure we're a bit more confident in the way that's actually being calculated. So you've probably heard more today about benchmarks than you ever really wanted to hear. However, I can keep on going longer if you want. But benchmarks are a very, which I'm sure no one does, but they are a very critical part of the plumbing of the financial system. As I said, they're right in the heart of the entrails. If they don't work, a decent chunk of the financial system doesn't work. It's important that market participants have an awareness of how they're calculated rather than simply taking them for granted. Even more importantly, they need to have confidence that they're calculated with robustness and integrity. So to help ensure that's the case, a number of reforms to benchmarks have been undertaken, both on the foreign exchange space and on the interest rate space. That process is still ongoing. We're not, certainly not got to the end of that process. And we need to make sure that this part of the market gets to a better place than where it has been in the past. So said, as in my speech, I provide you with a lot more other material. If you actually care about this stuff, we can go ahead and read a bit more about it. As I said, it's something, if you're a serious participant in the financial markets, you actually should have a decent awareness of and understanding of. So let me finish there. And what we head over, to Leather.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Candace Zacharias. I cover FX and bonds. Do you want to go over there? And I can for Bloomberg from Sydney. Thank you, Guy, very much for starting us off on the discussion about improved functioning in markets and benchmarks in the FX and rate space. And I'm sure we're going to circle back to questions about this later, but I thought maybe to start us off and to sort of set the background for where we are today, maybe I can get your thoughts on what might be the most important question facing market participants today is what happens in December if the Fed raises interest rates for the first time in a decade, at the same time as the European Central Bank might be changing policy as well. What's the potential for disorderly market activity, and what do you think is going to happen?
So I have no idea as to what's going to happen in December, or at least no particular insight. Let me say a few things. So the Fed rate rise, should it actually occur, would be the most telegraphed rate rise in the history of rate rises. And for anyone to not be prepared for its eventuality, they really have no excuse. And if they suffer as a consequence, it's probably warranted. As I said, this has been coming for a long time, possibly more than Godot. So, but hopefully we won't be still waiting for Godot this time next year. So as I said, you've been warned. You can't say that you haven't been. So that said, I'm sure there are products out there which are still hoping that they get out just in time, and they're predicated on zero funding costs, and they won't work when funding costs are no longer zero, at least in the US. What they are, not sure. Where they are, I don't think they're on the books of the core part of the banking system. I'd be surprised if they're not out there. I think one thing which is interesting is, and like I mentioned Simon Potter earlier, and he gave a talk about this sometime in the past 24 hours, the Fed is moving to, the Fed's balance sheet is four times larger than it was when rates last went up. Which brings me, actually reminds me of another fact, is it's 10 years since the Fed last raised interest rates. That means there's a decently large chunk of people in the financial markets who have never known what happens when the Fed actually raises interest rates. So we'll see how that goes. As Simon said, the Fed is operating with a balance sheet which is considerably larger than it's been in the past. They've got a bunch of new tools, which they haven't tested. They've tested them, but they don't really know how they're going to operate. So there'll be a bit of learning by doing. So learning by doing generally entails a bit of volatility. On top of that, I think it'll be interesting because we'll hit December 31st, soon after the Fed raises interest rates, and we saw a reasonable amount of interesting market functioning activity on September 30 this year in a number of markets. And there's some chance, and part of that is as balance, a lot of some balance sheet constraints at quarter end. So if you overlay that on top of an environment where the Fed's trying out some new tools, I think this, you know, December 31st in particular could be interesting. But as you said, and at the same time, as you said, the ECB's possibly going the other way. So, I mean, as much as the Fed's interest rate rise has been telegraphed, the ensuing volatility is also being talked about ad nauseum. But we may, you know, and we've been also waiting for that for a long period of time, but we may actually get there this December if the Fed does actually raise rates.
I was going to ask, is it concerning that, you know, in August we saw quite a big uptick in volatility, and obviously there were other things going on, but there was a September Fed meeting to look forward to. We're not really seeing, you know, spikes in volatility right now. Why is that? Why are we seeing a calm before the storm, or are people on holiday?
No, they're not on holiday. That was possibly true in August, but not true now. Even the volatility we saw in August it was high in some markets, wasn't high in others. In fact, I'd still say by and large, the most interesting story is that volatility has been reasonably benign throughout this whole period. And again, partly coming back to the length of experience of people in financial markets, if you look at some of the volatility that people have been remarking on lately, in the greater scheme of things, it's not all that high.
Mm-hmm.
It may well get higher. One thing we do know, also we don't know. The one thing, if you look at experience, is that when the Fed has raised interest rates, and we don't have that many started the interest rate cycle, things seem to tend to happen afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And it's be surprising if that wasn't the case this time around. And one of the things which does seem to happen is volatility spikes, or shifts to a higher level. But as I said, people have been warned about this for a long time. One of the things that most people are expecting as a consequence is that volatility will be higher. So I would assume that people have at least positioned themselves to deal with it when it naturally arrives.
Let me maybe move on a little bit. And I want to ask you about what some people are calling the unintended consequences of regulation. You've talked about benchmark changes. In the FX space, for example, people we talk to say that, you know, the offer spreads are widening in some smaller G10 currencies. The New Zealand dollar had a very good example in August where it sort of tanked for about 10 minutes and then recovered. We're seeing similar things happening in Norway, Sweden, sometimes in Australia before RBA decisions. Do we now have issues with pockets of illiquidity in the FX market, and is that going to come to a head in December?
Are there pockets of illiquidity in FX? Yes, there are on occasion. I mean, you mentioned it's ahead of our... So if you look at what happens ahead of our rate announcements now, the bid offer goes from a pip or two a few minutes prior to 40, 50 points in the minute prior. So that's a lot. That's a wide bid offer for NFX. More generally, though, I mean, and this is true in FX, it's true in fixed income, it's true in equities. So for most of the time, and particularly in more benign times, top of book liquidity is probably as good as it's ever been. Bid offer is as low as it's ever been. The question is more around market depth. And you mentioned the New Zealand dollar episode back in September, I think it was. Amongst other things, so one that happened in the middle of the night in New Zealand, so no one actually trading in New Zealand, presumably actually go to sleep, was actually, missed it. And I made this comment about the bond market, the flash rally on October 15 last year in Treasuries. If you went out for a well-timed cup of coffee, you missed the whole episode. And that raises the interesting question is, so do these liquidity events matter, or illiquidity events matter? I mean, the concern people have is that we don't understand what's driving them. So if it's the case that you can always be confident there's a liquidity blip and then the market returns to where it was a few minutes prior, and you can pretty much ignore it, that's okay. But the concern, I think, seems to be that we'll have this liquidity pocket and then the market will continue to gap lower. One thing, again, which is interesting in terms of the October 15 Treasury episode, there was no price gapping.
Mm-hmm.
There was continuous pricing throughout that whole episode, basis point at a time, with a large amount of volume behind it. It wasn't, so it's often referred to inappropriately as a flash crash. A, it was a rally, not a crash. And B, there was no price gapping. It was smooth price action. That wasn't true of the FX episodes you were talking about. But they were fairly short-lived. And as I said, if you are a person with a slightly more medium-term perspective, i.e. longer than a minute, then, it's not something you necessarily need to get to, it's not going to affect the way you operate. as I said, the concern we have, and this was expressed particularly around the Treasury episode, is we just don't understand why, in arguably the most liquid market in the world, these sort of price movements can actually happen. Mm. And the lack of understanding means you're concerned that if you don't understand what's going to happen, then, you know, so far all these episodes have resolved in a fairly benign manner, but we can't be confident that's going to be the case in the future.
Can we sort of blame some of the automated trading that you were talking about, creating the illusion of liquidity and depth and sort of acting like a bad friend and going away when you really need it?
Well, they would say no. I mean, that's a very somewhat controversial question in the whole liquidity provision discussion, is that, so the people who are providing the liquidity at the moment are different from those who are providing liquidity in the past. And so a lot of them are, so you don't call them high frequency traders anymore, you call them proprietary trading firms. That's the new way, the perfect way to refer to them. But they are, I mean, they are providing liquidity. The question is, when an event happens, do they get out of the way? But that's still very much an open question. If you talk to them about the October 15 episode, they will say they were there the whole time, and indeed they were. The other question which is relevant to this is the more traditional market makers, the investment banks of the world, they were pretty good at getting out of the way of large price movements in the past as well. So the traditional way of not providing liquidity to the market was, A, I don't answer my phone, or B, my bid offer suddenly widens considerably. And so I am technically still in the market, but could you actually transact with me? Possibly not. That said, but I think what we're seeing at the moment is actually an evolutionary process. So a lot of these new participants in the market in terms of liquidity provision, so there is no customer relationship. They are in the market. They don't have any visibility or relationship with the customer. It's not clear to me that that's always going to be the case. But as their presence in the market continues to evolve, they may actually start to care about reputation and customer relationships in the way that the current market makers or the traditional market makers have. That's not necessarily going to be the case, but as I said, we're in this evolutionary phase, and we're not quite sure where it's going to end up. Wherever it's going to end up, it is not going to be back to where we were.
Yeah.
And you talked about the words unintended consequences, which is the phrase I think is the most abused phrase around regulation in financial markets. Most, if not all, but probably most, of the consequences are intended. You may not like them, and the people who don't like them say that they're unintended, but actually they're intended. And the idea was, you know, if you look at liquidity provision, for instance, it was clearly underpriced prior to 2007. Now it costs. Has the price gone up too much? Maybe. Whatever it is, as I said, it's not going back to where it was. And you can complain all you like about it, but it's not going to go back there anytime soon. And so you might as well just accept that that's the way it's going to be for the time being and adjust. Doesn't mean that we're in the right spot and that conversation is still worth having, but it's not going to turn around and go back to where it was anytime in a hurry. And so I think, you know, market participants do need to adjust to the current environment, regardless of whether it's actually right or not.
Okay, I want to move on to a group of people who've been liquidity providers in a different sense. Large reserve managers, we've seen some of them change the way that they behave recently. I'm wondering how much of an impact that's having on market activity and whether people are sort of discounting it a little bit.
Yeah, I sort of think that, I mean, with some exceptions, but I think that's been somewhat neglected. If you think about it, there's the largest asset manager in the world, and then some opponent reminds me that the Fed's balance sheet is larger. But anyway, the safe. So the reserves in China have gone from $4 trillion to $3.5 trillion. So it's a $0.5 trillion portfolio shift in 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big number. So if you think, we don't know exactly what they're holding, probably some treasuries, because they seem to be holding a bit less of them now than they did a year ago. But if you think about the size of that flow, that's going to be, has to have a material effect on whatever markets they're actually in. On top of that, you've got some of the large oil-related sovereign wealth funds who are now running down some of their holdings because of the fall in the oil price. And, if you take the Saudis, for instance, they're running a budget deficit of about 25% of GDP, 10 times larger than our budget deficit, which they're funding by running down some of their accumulated earnings in their sovereign wealth fund. So, again, if you think about those sort of flows, they're large. So we don't, and as I said, on the same side in China, we've had $500 billion fall in the Chinese reserves holdings. On the other side of that, there's been a $500 billion capital outflow from the private sector in China, also a big number, over the past 12 months. These things have surely got to be having an impact on markets, and where some of these entities were participating in markets and they're not anymore, it's probably also contributing to some of the dislocation that we're seeing in pricing. So in the sense that if you think about, take the treasury market, for a number of years we've had the Fed buying bonds, we've had SAFE buying bonds, we've had other Asian reserve managers buying bonds. None of those are buying, and two of those are at least selling now. That's a different dynamic than what we've seen for much of the past decade or so.
And do you think we're seeing this in the bond market, in the swap market? Where do you think we're seeing the biggest impact?
I think it's clearly in the bond market. I think it's also potentially in the swap market as well, and contributing to some of the developments we're seeing there. The other thing I think which we're seeing, particularly in something like the swap market, you talk about the consequences of regulation. So it's one of the consequences of regulation is to increase the cost of, has increased the cost of providing a lot of balance sheet services.
Mm-hmm.
It's taken quite a long time for some of that repricing to flow through to other market segments. And I think we're only just starting to, see that in repo. We're only just starting to see that in the swap market. And so there's this digestion phase as people start to work out what the consequences are. So if you take swap spreads at the moment, which are, you know, interesting position here, that same in the US, same in Canada and the UK. It seems to be very much an Anglo phenomenon. It's not happening in Europe. Anyway, one of the reasons is that people who previously had arbitraged those movements away aren't doing that this time around because they haven't got the balance sheet capacity to do it. If you guys are free plug, so Lisa Abramowitz has a piece on this on Bloomberg in the last 24 hours, is that, you know, there's a change in the way that a lot of the markets are actually functioning.
Mm-hmm.
And some market participants haven't quite adjusted to that change. And I said some traditional arbitrages in the past aren't there at the moment. Doesn't mean that what we're seeing at the moment is a problem. It's just different.
Yeah.
And as I said earlier, to some extent, so hedging strategies which may have been effective in the past may not be effective in the future. The price of a lot of services, which was very low in the past, isn't going to be quite so cheap in the future. That's something you need to take account of.
I won't keep it on China, and then I'll open up if there are any questions. Just one last question. China recently, we imagine the yuan is going to be included into the IMF's SDR basket. And I was wondering, some people have commented about what that means for Australia, whether it saps demand for Aussie debt, perhaps the currencies. Is that something you think is going to happen?
Not anytime soon. I mean, I don't. So, for sovereign wealth funds or central bank reserve managers like ourselves, we've had access to the RMB for a while now. I mean, we have 5% of our reserves in RMB. So, you've always had that option. Some of the announcements the Chinese have made particularly over the last couple of months, have increased the liquidity around those reserve holdings more than was the case in the past. But by and large, if you wanted to hold RMB, you could.
Mm-hmm.
And people have. At the same time, while they've made a number of changes to increase the liquidity, it's probably not. I don't think people are holding Aussie as a proxy for RMB holdings in their reserve portfolio. It's a diversification strategy away from basically, I would say, the G3 in terms of reserves. I don't see the RMB as sort of cannibalizing that demand. I think people are holding Aussie for other reasons in their portfolio, not as a sort of RMB substitute, so that once the RMB becomes more available, they switch out. So if you're, I wouldn't be holding my breath for that sort of change to occur. And if we look at the reserve managers who hold Aussie in their portfolio, certainly have seen no evidence of any behaviour change.
I'm going to open up, David. Do we have any questions from the audience?
Paul Dales from Capital Economics, he was asking a question, I think, before any of us arrived this morning, so he's long overdue. He was pointing out that their forecast for underlying inflation in Australia has it falling below the bottom of the 2-3% target range and staying below it for a while. It's obviously something we've seen in a lot of other economies, which are experiencing stubbornly low core inflation. How would the bank react if that did happen?
Well, I don't think we have a reasonably well-articulated reaction function. That's not our forecast, though. Let me turn that around and throw it back to the US. I mean, one thing which I think is interesting at the moment is, so I still believe that supply curves slope upwards, you know, radical concept that is, so that as you know, if you think about as unemployment rates continue to fall, and the best example would be the US, at some point you'll actually hit a point where the labor supply curve actually slopes upwards and you might actually start to see some wage pressure actually emerge. So I think the surprise, and I mean, this gets to the question is why is underlying inflation structurally low everywhere in the world? In the US, it's only about 0.5 percentage point below where they actually want it. But anyway, you know, if we get to the point, if I mean, it basically boils back to a global demand story. If global demand or US demand is adequate enough to generate increased employment of the size of the increase that we've seen, particularly in the US over the past year or so, you get that again in the next year or so, and the unemployment rate's got a 4 in front of it. I'm guessing that you're going to get at some point, you're going to get to the point where the labor supply curve actually slopes upwards. You'll get domestic wage pressure. That puts a floor under any of your domestic inflation developments. So I said, I think it's been it. I think the surprise, to some extent, and the reasons for this aren't fully understood as to why, particularly in the US, where you've had this marked improvement in the labor market, you haven't got any particularly strong increase in wage pressure. But I said, if you delivered the same sort of improvement you've had in the labor market in the US over the next 12 months and you didn't get that, I would find that incredibly surprising.
There's another one from John Fields again of Chi-X, very active today. Makes an interesting question, possibly talking his own book a little bit here, but he says, isn't the solution for Forex markets to bring more trading onto lit exchanges, rather than allowing it to trade in a multitude of dark pools?
So I don't think it does. That's not a correct characterization of the state of the market. So one thing which is interesting, so it's been a fair amount of my by the nightlife before I became, was on benchmarks, was on high frequency trading in FX, so something for some idea about. One thing which is interesting is, so we did a decent amount of work on this 5 or 6 years ago, and HFT had just had really penetrated into the foreign exchange market over the 5 years prior to that, having come from the equity space, and now they're moving into fixed income as the market structure changes there. If you look at what's happened in the FX space, so some of the core parts of the FX market on some of the platforms like that provided by this institution, but also by Reuters and EBS. They've changed some of the trading rules to deal with those participants in the market, including randomized pricing, minimum order fills, and the like. And so you've actually seen the market structure change so that the high-frequency part of the world is sort of off on the frontiers of the market where they pick each other off, whereas in some of the core parts of the market, there's a more the market structure is slightly different. So the market structure has actually evolved over the last little while. So it's not, and actually a decent chunk of it is actually in lit exchanges. What has changed, though, is there's been a lot more internalization of trading flows by some of the large sell side participants, which is sort of which is matching off order flow, and you see a lot of that happen through the fix. So, you know, some different people have different views as to how that is. But a lot of this comes back to the relationship between the sell side and the buy side and the transparency around that. So I would agree with him in terms of, I wouldn't use the word lit, but it's more about the transparency and post-trade reporting, which is important, not the exchange itself on which it actually happens. It may happen internally in a bank's internal matching engine, may happen on a platform like Reuters or EBS, or may happen on through a non-bank liquidity provider. What really matters is the post-trade transparency around that and the degree to which people. I mean, the other problem I've seen is that people will get that information and then have no idea to what they're actually supposed to do with it. But I think the understanding around that has also increased quite a lot over the last few years. And a final point on that is what's interesting in the FX market, as best as I can tell, so we reached peak HFT about 2 or 3 years ago. So the share of high-frequency traders in the market has basically plateaued over the last few years, hasn't kept on going up. What we're seeing now is a lot of them are shifted to fixed income, and part of the reason for that is it's just less profitable. What we're seeing is they're now shifting into fixed income, and that's leading to some of these, you know, we're hearing the same debate now in fixed income that occurred in FX 5 years ago and that occurred in equity sort of 5 years prior to that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I'm sorry if there were any questions from the floor we weren't able to address, but thank you, Guy, and thank you for being such a good audience.
Thanks, Guy.